It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome, everyone, to episode number 4 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective of wrestling at the Mecca, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back, as always, is a man that went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting in August 30th, 1971, Mr. Wrestling himself, John Arizzi. John, how are you doing today?
I am doing fabulous, man. It's been quite a wonderful week, and I love reminiscing about what happened 50 years ago. It makes me feel as old as I am.
And if you'd like to be one of the first people to hear 50-year flashback of wrestling at Madison Square Garden, all you got to do is go to our Patreon, www.patreon.com/John Arizzi. Members in the Superfan, PWS Associate Producer, Producer, or Executive Producers tier will get access to this show early. And starting at only $5 a month, it'll get you in the door and you'll have access to all the original Pro Wrestling Spotlight original broadcasts from 1989 to 1995. And the higher the level, the more benefits you'll get. From Zoom calls with John Arizzi, access to 8mm films we discuss here, to unseen videos and vintage magazines being sent out to you. And there's only one way to experience it all, and that's becoming a member of John's Patreon page, patreon.com/John Arizzi. Join the community, hear the history, patreon.com/John Arizzi. John, is there anything new coming up in the Patreon you want to talk about?
Well, Tim, there's always new stuff on the Patreon. I mean, we've been uploading content each and every week. Every Sunday, I put up new content. I mean, we have the classic stuff from 1972 with Bruno Sammartino and Pedro Morales put up there recently. Every Sunday is a surprise for my patrons. They don't know what they're going to get. And basically what I do is I pull a box out and I stick my hand in it. There was a game years ago in the 60s called Feely Mealy. I don't know if you had that board game. Do you remember what that board game was?
I think it was you put your hand in the box and got to figure out what's inside the box.
Exactly. And that's how you win. So Feely Mealy, that's what I do with the cassette tapes. I pick out a few and then I see what's on there. And, you know, some of them are embarrassing. And because when you hear them, I mean, there's my little voice on there. My sister screaming in the background, babies crying, my little niece, my mom, my brother-in-law, everyone's watching wrestling and I'm trying to shush them all. But that's all on the tapes as well. But Feely Mealy, here's a quick funny story about my mom. My mom had a great sense of humor and she had dentures. So, I mean, we decided to play Feely Mealy and, you know, I stick my hand in the box and her freaking dentures are in there. She kind of, you know, was sly and that's a memory that was crazy. And I was like, oh my God. And she was laughing and with no teeth. But that was kind of the way our household was back then.
What I love about the Patreon is you don't have these things exactly lined up. You have so many archives, John, so many archives. We were just doing it before the podcast, talking about some of the archives you have from Freddie Blassie and stuff. And you have so many great stuff. You just never know what you're going to put up there. So every time I go on, I'm like, oh, what's this or what's that? And you don't even know because you just pull out a box. You go, I'll grab this, and I'll throw this up. So it's always a pleasure. And if you can get in for so cheap, but the larger ones, if you want to spend more, it'll be worth your while. If you can't, no problem. But if you want to and you go, hey, I would like this or would like that, like the $100 one, I think is.
Well, that's almost- for the executive producer. We only have one of those right now. And the guy gets like listed as the executive producer on the podcast and on the uploads. And then we I send him 4 wrestling magazines a month. I mean, that those were from the 60s and 70s. So there's your value right there. And I send those to people who are in the $25 or up level. And we also, for that $25 a month level, we do video chats with them every month. They get, there's even, you know, photo uploads. I upload photo sets on watermark so they can print them out and use them. And we have just so many perks. I mean, the 8mm films, but for $5, you're getting the podcast, the John Arezzi's Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast, 5 days before it's released nationally, internationally. So you get that, and you get all the archives of the Pro Wrestling Spotlight radio show uncut with commercials in them from April 9th, 1989, right through the current episode we just uploaded was from November of 1991, because each week we're covering a show from 30 years to the week. So we have so many cool things on that Patreon account, patreon.com/John Arezzi. Come on in for $5 a month, browse it, take a look around, listen to the content. I mean, for $10 a month, you're getting all of that historic audio interviews that I did backstage at Madison Square Garden with the likes of the Valiant Brothers and Lou Albano, the Grand Wizard, Freddie Blassie, just so much classic stuff. So it's worth $5 a month. It's worth $10 a month. And we really would appreciate your support, because that really helps cover the cost of everything that we do.
Yeah, all the things that we talk about on this show have to be put together. I think that's interesting. These shows you have from the 80s into the 90s are on cassette. So someone's got to, you know, dub them over, load them up, put them somewhere you can get. So it takes time, and that's what it is. It's actually just paying for itself. It's helping us put these shows together, and we appreciate it. So it's not like you're paying one thing and you get the same thing over and over again. You just never know what you're going to be getting when you join the Patreon.
Yeah, and now we have the YouTube channel rocking. I mean, the YouTube channel is with clips every single week. I mean, almost every day we're putting up new YouTube clips now. And the name of the YouTube account is simply youtube.com/Pro Wrestling Spotlight. So go to that, and that gives you a really good taste of what's going on the podcast. We got, you know, we got to pay for the illustrator and the guy who does the graphics. So Patreon really just covers the costs of what we're doing on the hard cost side, because it, you know, it literally is a little over $1,000 a month, you know, with the team and, you know, the distribution subscription fee you got to pay. But we're building it. It's building nicely. I'm very excited. It's good to be on your own and independent from anyone. You could do what you want. You can control it. You can see all your analytics. And I'm really having a ball with it. And this show, as a new podcast out there, is gaining a lot of traction, Tim, a lot of traction.
That's fantastic. So this is also available early. So it won't be on the 50th anniversary. If you become a Patreon member, you get to hear this show early.
Yes, you do. You'll get the show at least a week early from when the date of the show was. Like, for example, this is December 6, 1971, and everyone's going to get it December 1st.
That's fantastic.
Hey, listen, one thing. I'm sorry. I gotta say, this is your entry. I don't even know how you're doing this with us, because this is Christmas season. And I know that your alter ego is Santa Claus, and you got a great podcast for the Olympics, but you also, let's just talk to you a second before we get into the show about Christmas, Santa Claus, what you do, because that is such a noble thing, because everybody loves Santa Claus. And the only other person I know who does Santa is Mick Foley every year, and you're doing it too. So tell us a little bit about that. I'm interviewing you for a second before we get started with the show.
Well, basically, I started it last year. We were going through COVID, and it was a pandemic going on. No one really can go outside, and I was using Zoom a lot. And I was like, you know something? We could do Santa Claus like this. So I started looking into it, thinking I had this great idea, $1 million idea. And then I found a whole community of Santas that do it. So I was like, oh my gosh. So I started telling friends and family members about, you know, I will give 15 minutes for so much money to sit down with your child and stuff and do a Zoom with Santa. And I got a friend who does it, and we were talking about it, and he goes, well, this is what I do. He puts a form together, John. So I put a form together, and basically the form is, if I'm talking to you, it'll be like, what's your name, boy or girl, how old they are, Do you have an elf on the shelf? Do you have a dog? And you play along with that. Johnny, do you have a dog, Johnny? What's your dog's name? So if you had a dog, you'd tell me.
Gigi.
Oh, Gigi. Okay, grab Gigi. So the kid will go grab
He's
Gigi.
He's dead.
Okay, so if you can grab Gigi and bring him to the Zoom, yeah. You bring it, pull Gigi, go, Gigi, this is Santa Claus. Do me a favor. I want to bring little Johnny some toys on Christmas Eve, so please don't bark and don't bite Santa. Can you tell Gigi that? And you tell Gigi, and you just get into the—so the form I give them really goes into detail about their child or childs or kids— whatever.
Yeah.
And it just, you get involved like that. So they really start to believe. And that's the joy of it for me is a couple of different things. One thing is, you know, you can only believe in Santa Claus for so long because once you stop, it's over. So enjoy the years that you can enjoy Santa Claus with your child before it's over, before some other kid in elementary school goes, there's no Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And the other it's thing I get to do, which is really enjoyable to me, is like giving back to the community. Going to last year, a friend of mine, his sister's house burnt down, and the kids were staying at a hotel, and we did a Zoom like that. And I called my buddy up. I go, hey, would they mind me showing up at the hotel for them? And she's like, oh, that'd be fantastic. I said, okay, great. So I showed up at the hotel for the kids, and I had a distance. We had a distance, and I said to him, I said, well, I have so many toys in my bag. I was wondering if I could bring some of yours early. Is that okay with you? And they're like, oh, my gosh. And I gave him, you know, toys, a backpack
That's
and stuff.
Wonderful.
It's just, you know, it's just a small amount of time, and once it's gone, it's gone. So I really enjoy being Santa and be able to give back to my community and stuff like that. It's a fun thing to do. It's fun.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's absolutely a great thing to do. And now we're in smack dab in the middle of the Christmas season right now because, you know, we're covering December. It is December. Christmas is just a few weeks away. So how does someone get a hold of you to perhaps have this wonderful, magical experience for their kids?
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. It's on Instagram. It's called Jolly Santa Tim on Instagram. And if you shoot me a message, I'll give you 25% off of a visit with Santa, a virtual visit with Santa. Say you got to mention John's name. I heard you on MSG, you know, our 50-year flashback. And say you know John, and then I'll send you an email and say, hey, I love John. Here's 25% off, and here's a form to fill out. And once you fill out the form, you send it back to me, and I'll give you a call and go, okay, let's figure out a good time that we can have you been on. Where are you going to do? Is it for you? Is it for your grandchildren? Is it for your niece or nephew? So I get people doing it for other family members, other things. And I want to make sure it's okay with the parents, you know?
Yeah, I have two great, great nieces, not a great niece, two great, great nieces. One is six and the other one is two. So I think I'm going to have Santa Tim do a Zoom with these young ladies out in Colorado is where they live.
I love it. I'd love to do it. It's fun for me. It's fun for the family. Everyone gets involved in it. And being last year that there was a pandemic going on, it was really big. This year will be probably not as big being the Zooms, but, you know, John, it was amazing. I was doing ones in Japan. I did some in Germany.
Santa's universal, man.
He's universal, but I didn't know how people, I was always asked, how'd you find out about me? How'd you find out about, oh, I heard you on here. I heard my friend had this done. They thought it was fantastic. So I want to do it for my, you know, the kids are in the army and they're over in Germany, stationed in Germany and have grandkids. Can we be part of it? And like, oh, absolutely. So we all get on the Zoom together. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Around this time that we're going to cover this episode, I attempted to be Santa Claus for my nieces and nephews out on Long Island. And it was in 75. I remember it now. That I had a plastic Santa suit. It was a plastic suit. You know, I didn't have the resources or just was too lazy to go try on a real Santa suit. And I had, you know, the beard. And then I had cotton balls that I taped on my eyebrows. They were cotton. I put little red cheeks. And, you know, my sister, older sister, wakes the kids up. Santa Claus is here. Santa Claus is here. And I was freaking sweating in this plastic suit. I mean, because it was like you're in a trash bag and the kids come downstairs all kind of confused and they look and they see me and all of a sudden one of the eyebrows falls off and my niece is like, that's not Santa, that's Uncle Johnny.
Oh.
So that ruined it for them. But anyway, we got a good laugh out of it.
I grew the beard. This is why I grew my beard. I'm actually getting it dyed tomorrow.
Looks good.
Yeah, it's going to be I'm a real bearded Santa because I never wanted to be. I'm looking at pictures, John. So you mentioned that. I saw pictures of when I was with Santa back when I was a kid. My parents had a Santa come to class and he had a mask on. And I'm looking at it now. I'm horrified now, John.
Yeah,
looking
of course.
At it. I couldn't imagine as a kid. I was like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh.
I mean, so, you were kind of scared, right?
Yeah. Oh, I was totally scared of this guy.
And think of what we're going to do now. Now we're going to go from Santa Claus to the vampire, Freddie Blassie, in this episode.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's only on this show. Only on this show. I'd like to start off with something a little different. We always like to do a little before we do the matches.
Yes.
Going into the WWF titles, they had a lot of tournaments or matches that never really happened. And I want to get your perspective on these. One of the first ones is about the WWF Heavyweight Championship being awarded to Buddy Rogers in 1963. So they said he won a tournament in Rio de Janeiro, defeating Antonio Rocca in the finals. What do you know about, like, why would they do something like that? If I had to go see a match between Buddy Rogers and Antonio Rocca, I think it'd be fantastic. Why would they make up a match like that?
There was a simple reason for it, and that was the Worldwide Wrestling Federation was formed at that time. They were separating the territory. So the NWA title, they had to find a way to get the title off of Buddy Rogers. So to appease him and to have Vince McMahon Sr., do nicey-nice with the NWA, they created the WWF title and gave it to Rogers as a way to kind of appease him. But they were not enamored with Buddy, too. So, I mean, it was a way to get the title on him, but it was more of a transitional situation to get the title on Bruno Sammartino, who they really wanted to put the world championship on. Bruno was not someone that the NWA wanted to put the title around because he was considered too ethnic. He was Italian. And in the Northeast, that was the selling point, was that he had this huge Italian following. And, you know, Antonino Rocca, Argentina Rocca, whatever you call him, there's different ways to call him that. But he had that huge ethnic following in New York at the Garden and was, just an icon and a legend there. That was kind of the tradition that Vince McMahon Sr. did. I mean, he wanted an ethnic champion to draw in those fans of that champion, whether it was Rocca, Sammartino, then Pedro Morales, who was Puerto Rican.
Interesting. I never knew that. So I was wondered why they wouldn't do something like that. So you got Buddy
Rogers. That's why they call me a historian. I am.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And Antonio Rocca, he was in great shape.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing something in one of Apter's magazines, talking to him about living to like he was like 150 years old
because
he found that secret. But he died. It seemed he died pretty early. He died at like 49.
Young, yeah,
49.
I mean, he died really young. 40. What is it? 49. Tim. Yeah,
something like that. He died in. That's the whole. There's a little controversy of when he was born and when he passed away in March 15th of 1977. They're saying he was 49. He could have been a little older. We're not really sure. But like,
it might have been because he was back and doing some announcing with Vince McMahon. Man, and you know, maybe there was maybe it kind of sped the death along a little bit, you know, all the pressure that he might have been under at the time. Who the hell knows? But he died at a young age. He didn't live to 150 reported in the magazines.
Going back to the matches that never really happened, one of the reasons we're talking about it today because we have one of the tag teams is Luke Graham and Tarzan Tyler. Supposedly, they won the title in 1971. They lost it coming up. We will hear about that. But supposedly they beat Dick the Bruiser and the Sheik on June 3rd. However, there's no records of this. Why would you go through this all this trouble? Why not have just a match that they'd win the title?
I think there was a situation where the titles were last on Beppo and Guido, the Mongols. Beppo being Nikolai Volkov later on. For whatever reason, they left the territory or they split up and the titles were then vacant and they figured a way that they'd do a tournament, a phantom tournament, and give the titles to Crazy Luke Graham and Tarzan Tyler. So that's how that happened.
There's actually three different ones. One of them was the Mongols beating the Mongols. The other one was winning a tournament in New Orleans. So again, places that you wouldn't believe. But then the last one for me was interesting. Pat Patterson. Pat Patterson and the Intercontinental Championship in September 3rd of 1979, the WWF introduced the Intercontinental Championship, a secondary championship, to the for mid-card wrestlers like Patterson was.
Right.
And he was crowned the first Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion after allegedly a tournament in Rio de Janeiro. Yeah. What's with Rio de Janeiro? I guess because people
can't
go there. It's
probably a rib,
an
inside joke. That's all it was. There was no rhyme or reason behind it. They just thought it was funny.
Someone said that they picked it because Patterson couldn't pronounce Rio de Janeiro. Probably
that could be your. That could very well be the reason.
I just think that's hilarious. Let's dive into the show. December 6th, 1971. Attendance 22,091. Around the same they usually get. Going back with you, how did you get the tickets again this time, and where did you sit?
Well, it was once again a situation with me and Frank Favalli. My friend on Long Island, we had gone to all the shows together. I went to my first match with him and his dad. Then we had the big group in October. And then November was just Frank and I. And then I believe in this particular case, we actually went to the box office the night of the show in November to get the tickets for December. So we had like seventh row ringside. And then we got them right at the box office the night of the show.
So you got them the night of the show?
Yeah, the night of the show a month before. So we bought them on November 15th for the December 6th show. We figured, all right, let's just get out of our seats now because the card wasn't an outstanding one. We ran to the box office, got our seats and came back for the end of the show. You know, we made sure we saw Blassie. You know, there's a whole big story about that whole day. I was on pins and needles all day anyway. But that's how we did it. But, you know, he's like, oh, we got seventh row. What the hell? You know, we thought we'd get first or second row, but that didn't happen.
Didn't happen. But let me ask you this. Bat, you were what now? You're still 14, correct?
Yes, I was 14 years old. I was going to turn 15 in January of 72.
Okay. What were your parents thinking at the time, saying, were they against you going to the Garden once a month? Were they okay with it? Was it at the time, was it something that kids your age could do?
I think it was a different time and place. My dad worked nights and my mom, you know, she was always afraid, you know, what, be careful and stay together, you know, but she wasn't comfortable with me getting on a train, going to the Garden. And then, you know, then we'd have to get on that 11:10 train at Penn Station and get the train back to Babylon. So we got home after midnight and take a cab from the train station to the house, or Frank's father would pick us up, whatever it was. But, you know, she wasn't happy. She wasn't a happy camper about it. But, you know, she had to deal with it because I did it for years.
And it's just different, you know, when you talk about going to other places, like going to Mid-South, where you can you have to drive over to. This is the Garden. This is a major, you know, New York City, getting into New York City, learning your way around New York City, getting on the train to get home, because you can't take a cab home. You couldn't take a cab home. It'd be way too expensive. And it's just listening to it, how you had to go about getting your tickets and getting in there and getting out. When you're leaving, you can't hang out in the city anymore. You got to make that train, because if you miss that train, you're stuck.
You're
in the
screwed
city.
And then you got to wait an hour to get back, you know. And it was a nightmare. You know, I didn't have a good time convincing her that I was flying to California to see the Battle Royal in Los Angeles in 1974, but that's a story for another day.
Let's start off the first match. Mario Soto defeated Mike Monroe, 10 minutes, 47 seconds. Kind of interesting about this. First of all, it's kind of like a TV match at the best. Out of like 47 appearances at the Garden, Mario Soto finally gets a win. But 10 minutes for the first match seems like a long time. Why do you think it was?
There were, you know, that was kind of a filler for people to get into their seats. And Mike the Moose Monroe was kind of a guy who won sometimes on TV, as did Manuel Soto. So this was a good, they were good workers. They knew how to put on a match and just to kind of get the crowd in, because the crowd really never settled in until like the first or second match. I mean, they were still filtering in from everywhere. And the show started kind of late anyway. It started at 8:30.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense. And then the second match, now we're going to our tag team matches, which on this card, there's three tag team matches. It's a special attraction with the little people. people, better known at the time as Midgets, Farmer Jeremy and Sonny Boy Hayes defeated Little Brutus and Sky Lolo 2 out of 3 falls after 21 minutes and 9 seconds. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's a lot of comedy in that match, you know, chasing the referee around, rolling around the ring with them, people laughing. It was really just comedy seeing the Midgets, and they always put on a good show, and they were, and a lot of these guys, they went around the horn together, so they knew each other so well. There wasn't a big, like dozens and dozens of them. And they all traveled together, and they knew each other's moves very well. It was very choreographed. I mean, out of all the matches, the Midgets matches were pretty choreographed, where they did the same spots over and over again, town after town after town. But it was pure just comic relief.
I think the only midget or little person that I can remember was the Haiti Kid, because he had that whole angle with Mr. T later on.
Right, and he used to do the cocoa butt. Right. He did a headbutt.
I think so. Yeah. That's the only one I know. But I remember watching them, and they were great performers, and they used to get the referee involved in it, and everyone would have a good time. And it is a good time to bring in people. So now we're talking like there's 30 minutes into the show, and we've seen these two matches. Third match, Chief J Strongbow versus Stan Stasiak, ended in a time limit draw of 20 minutes. Now, let's go back to Stan Stasiak. He's already done 2 great house shows with Pedro. Then he loses last month to Gorilla Monsoon on November 15th. Now he draws with Jay. And now, spoiler alert, he has a couple more losses coming up. He was there for 6 months, but like he only had really 2 good months there. And after that, now he starts falling down the card.
Yeah, I mean, that happened around the horn. You know, you do your 2 matches that you were signed up to, bring you into the territory to do. And he did those with Morales. And then basically what they do, the Garden always had the main events first. So then Stasiak probably did a run with Morales after their 2 matches at the Garden. Then they would do Philadelphia, then they would Boston, they do Pittsburgh, and they do Baltimore and Rhode Island. And so then he would have his main event status in some of the other towns where they were running shows. And then you go to the Garden, and you just kind of segue him out until he leaves and then eventually comes back.
And that's another question I want to hit you on. When we're talking about like a Stan Stasiak, a known guy who's really good, when he's going around the horn, is he only going to like the Bostons and the Philadelphias and things like that? Or is he playing smaller house shows also? And did they have them at the time?
Well, they did. They didn't have like little Jack Witchie's Arena, and they still run a little town in White Plains. It's Westchester County Center where they do smaller shows, 2,000 or 3,000 people. That's kind of a secondary or tertiary arena. So, you would work those shows as well. But in those smaller little venues, like there was a place called Sunnyside Gardens in Queens, which is a very small place, and the Brooklyn Roll-O-Rama up in the New York area. And there was basically a rolling rink where they'd put a ring up, and then you'd have him go over against like Emmanuel Soto or somebody like that.
Do you remember the one in Comac? The Comac Arena?
Yeah, it was the Long Island Arena. It was on Jericho Turnpike.
Yeah. I know they had hockey there one time, and they did have wrestling. I remember seeing that. So something like that, would that be a place that like a Stan Stasiak would go and be the headliner?
Yeah. You know, back then, yes. I mean, I don't think the arena was operational anymore in the 70s. It might have been. But you're exactly right. That's what used to happen.
When I used to go there, it was a flea market, so it was definitely past my time.
I missed that old place.
That was a good place. Let's go to match number 4. Victor Rivera defeated Jimmy Valiant in 12 minutes, 16 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, Rivera was a hot babyface there as well, and he had a huge, huge following. Fans loved him. Jimmy Valiant was kind of on his way out at this time. He was teaming up with Beautiful Bobby, and he had went from babyface to heel. And they were ready to send him off so he could then compete in some other territories. He did a lot of work in St. Louis. He did a lot of NWA stuff, AWA stuff. So, I don't know who had the idea to bring him back eventually with Johnny Valiant or John Valen or John L. Sullivan, as they called him initially, to form that tag team in Albano, who later became probably the most charismatic tag team that the WWF ever had.
Big fan of his. I remember Jimmy Valiant when he was later years in
the
NWA.
Boogie Woogie.
The Boogie Woogie Man. I thought, a mid-carder, but if you're talking about a whole card of wrestlers, he's the guy you want to see. He was very charismatic. He was a babyface at the time. Do you remember the first time you talked to him? Because I know later on in years you had him at one of your Weekends of Champions.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to reunite the Valiant brothers at that convention, but Johnny was talking to the WWF at the time, and Johnny didn't show up, even though he begged me to be at my 1991 convention, which I allowed him to do, but he didn't show up. Anyway, I talked to Jimmy Valiant for the first time. It was when the Valiant brothers were a tag team, and when I started to get press access, when I started to be able to go backstage and hang out with Napolitano and Bill Apter and do the interviews back there. And then I got to do a feature story on Jimmy in 1977. And I went to a show in St. Louis at the historic Kiel Auditorium where Jimmy was performing. And we made a plan to meet at the hotel and got to the hotel and took some pictures of him and then get my tape recorder out. And he's in the, you know, he's outside by the pool and he's, hey, brother, man, he goes, just write whatever the hell you want, man. I don't care what you write, you know, just write it and just, you know, use, you know, just say that you were me and da, 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 da. So, I mean, that's what a lot of guys did. But Jimmy was like, take the pictures. I don't need to do an interview, man. You just, you know, just write whatever you want. And that came out in Ring Wrestling Magazine.
When you're taking pictures of these guys, where are you taking them? I'm looking back at old pictures, and it always seems to be in like a high school gymnasium, or no, a high school auditorium with the curtain behind it.
The garden had a nice curtain background where we used to take the guys because we weren't allowed in the actual dressing room at Madison Square Garden back then in the 70s. There was an area in the back where everyone would stay. You couldn't go where the guys were getting changed, or, you know, you couldn't go in the actual dressing room. And then they'd come out and we'd bring them to the back, and that's where we conducted our interviews, and that's where we took the photographs. In Philadelphia, TV was a different story. It was like in the hall. Way leading out to the ring with the dressing room right in back of us. And there was this wall. And I never forget, you know, we show up one day and someone had graffitied the wall. So it was like, how are we going to take our pictures now? But every arena was different. The garden had a really big setup. So it was a lot of privacy. And the curtain always looked nice in the background of the guys. But in this particular case with Jimmy Valiant, it was just at the pool. It was at poolside. He was, you know, he just posed, he flexed. Those were the pictures that I took that night. And that was I never forget that show. I mean, it was superstar Billy Graham was on that card with the WWF title. It might have been in 76 or 75 or 600. You know, my memory's shot, but he had the title. And Harley Race fought Dory Funk Jr. that night. That was for the NWA title. That was a crazy good match.
I always loved seeing in the wrestling magazines wrestlers who were not in their wrestling gear. They could be in their street clothes, they can be in their car, or at the pool or something, or at home. It was always like, ooh, I'm getting an inside look.
Yeah, I tell you a funny story. I mean, because Gorilla Monsoon, he didn't like to pose a lot. I mean, he didn't wrestle a lot, you know, after a certain period of time. And he was the booker. He was the matchmaker at the Philadelphia TV tapings. So we all wanted to, you know, we wanted to take some pictures of Gorilla. So he's there in his slacks, and all of a sudden he takes his shirt off. And he didn't have the singlet or anything. It was just him, you know, nude from the waist up, which, you know, was not the most attractive thing in the world to look at. I should talk, but I'm not posing for pictures. And then I have pictures of him wearing like business slacks, topless, posing. And those pictures are quite the sight.
Hey, that's another thing. Like when someone comes running to the ring to help out, they always have their shirt off, but they have jeans on. You know, you always like, you couldn't put a shirt on? What's the matter? Couldn't put a shirt on? Let's go to our match number five. Our second tag team of the night, the Fabulous Kangaroos. I know you love these guys.
Yes.
Al Costello and Don Kent versus the Rugged Russians, my guys, Igor and Ivan.
Couldn't understand why they booked it. Heel versus heels, tag team, you know, both heel tag teams. And the Russians, of course, without the mask, just took it away anyway. I mean, you don't want to see them with the cutout. And then the Kangaroos were always a historic tag team. I mean, they were managed. They didn't have a manager on this particular show, but, you know, they were great because they used to throw these little boomerangs to the fans, you know, with a description of the Kangaroos. But it was great to see them because they were so historic. They were such a big part of wrestling tag team scene in the 60s. And this is like right around the time where they didn't really work that much longer, many years longer. But to see them at the Garden, and it was the second time I was able to see them, because in August they had faced the Funks, which was an amazing 45-minute draw August 30th. And now seeing them again against the Russians. And once again, though, they didn't go over. You know, why wouldn't they go over against the Russians, who were just kind of like this tag team that you'd see on TV sometime, always winning with the hoods. And then you see them at the Garden, you know, with the cutout mask. They deserve to lose to the Kangaroos, and they didn't. It was another freaking draw, and it wasn't something that made me very happy that night.
What were the Kangaroos like then? They're not on top anymore. They're kind of like going on their way down or whatever. Mm-hmm. Are they still good workers at that time, or, you know, or is it more the gimmick?
Well, the guys back then, I mean, work rate was work rate. I mean, if you knew how to throw a good punch and you could drop kick, and I mean, it wasn't as complex as it is today. So even though they were older guys, they still knew how to throw a punch, and they still knew how to draw heat, because they were heels. And so that's what the philosophy was back then. It's much different today, of course, but they knew how to get the crowd up and running. But I still think that it was a mistake. All these years later, 50 years later, that they were matched against the Russians, and they didn't go over. And it was kind of a throwaway situation. It was kind of a time waster. 2 out of 3 falls at the Garden. And it was a long match. It was getting a little dull. I was wanting to see Blassie.
You wanted to see your boy. And then match number 6 is another tag team match. But this, John, is your first time ever seeing a title change at Madison Square Garden. It's Carl Gotch and Rene Goulet defeated the champions Luke Graham and Tarzan Tyler to win the WWWF Tag Team Championship. This went for 17 minutes and 20 seconds. And like we said earlier, we really don't know when Luke Graham and Tarzan Tyler got the titles in the first place.
Right. But here's the deal. I mean, you know, the lineups that are out there and this particular card, I remember Gotch and Goulet beating Graham and Tyler. It was the last match of the show. They went on last, even though this lineup is like from top to bottom, but it was the last match of the show when they won the title. So I remember people going crazy. And then, you know, we had to leave because we had to catch the train and all of that. So, but it was the last match on the show. And I think during the Kangaroos against the Rugged Russians, we might have went out and got our tickets for the next show. But yeah, the Blassie, the main event was earlier on in the card.
Interesting. Yeah, we didn't have that in our notes here, but that's interesting that they did a main event one earlier. And maybe—
yeah, what they do a lot, though, Tim, is like on these lineups. I mean, they do it from opening match to main event, and they usually do like main event is always last in the listings. But in actuality, that show really featured the tag team title switch at the very end of the night. But we can go over it before, because Blassie's the main event anyway.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that next. But I was just wondering, like, we're still talking. I guess, you know, if you had the Blassie match and everyone like yourself came to see Blassie, I used to DJ at bars, and what they always would talk about is the last set. Have your best last set. And I had the best songs in my last set. Maybe I'll play one early or another one early, but I always had the best set last, because when you walk out, that's what you remember.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. And the fans left happy, and we were happy because, you know, getting back to the actual match itself, Gotch and Goulet doing their TV buildup as a tag team were getting over with the fans. They were two separate types of wrestlers. Gotch, of course, was, you know, such a great technical wrestler, and Goulet had, you know, he had some great moves, and they had a good chemistry between them. And Tyler and Graham, obviously, you know, great heels with Captain Lou Albano. And I don't even recall, I don't remember if Captain Lou accompanied them out at ringside that day. But it was historic, because no one expected the title to, you know, usually tag titles in that era were always won or lost on TV. It was very rare that they would be won or lost at a show like the Garden or a house show. Like, they never changed hands in Boston or Philly. It was always the Garden or TV. And the Garden was, you know, it was interesting to see an actual title change. And the fans left happy because Gotch and Goulet were crowned the new WWWF Tag Team Champions. It was a very memorable match for me. I remember because I loved Gotch and Goulet as a tag team.
You know, funny you say that about tag teams, because now you're reminding me that, yeah, I saw a lot of tag teams change hands on TV. I saw Jay and Jules Strongbow beat Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito. I remember when Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas won the title from the Samoans.
What a match.
You know, these are just all TV stuff, and it never clicked until you just said that they're on TV. And then other matches, you know, like Randy Savage beat Tito Santana at the Boston Garden, you know, or I think Don Morocco. I think he won his title at the Garden, at Madison Square Garden. Mm-hmm. So I guess they're saving, you know, the big ones like the heavyweight championship and the Intercontinental Championship for bigger arenas, not just giving away on TV.
Mm-hmm. True.
Let's go to the match that you've been waiting for and everyone's been waiting for. But let's start off with, before we get into the Pedro Morales defending his WWF heavyweight title against Freddie Blassie in a Roman Gladiator match, first I want to go back to Freddie Blassie. You saw him live for the first time last month. Now you're coming back this month, and you're not coming alone. You're bringing something with you. Describe your thought process of you just saw Freddie Blassie, and before you're going to see him again, you want to ask him something. Describe that for me, because I don't know how you put this together.
Yeah, well, it was kind of like me loving Blassie the way I did and respecting him as a villain and a hero on the West Coast. And, you know, the more I read the magazines and got deeper into it and read about fan clubs, I wanted to start a fan club for Fred. And I read in the magazines that the only way that you could start a fan club is you need to get the wrestler's permission on a permission slip. So it was like I had this whole thing concocted in my head that I'm going to get this fan club started for Blassie, and I'm going to meet Freddie Blassie at the Garden on December 6th because I'm going to get this permission slip and I'm going to get backstage and Freddie's going to sign my permission slip for me and I'm going to get the chance to meet Freddie Blassie. So I, you know, my little typewriter at home, I type out like a 5-line permission slip, you know, I, Fred Blassie, hereby give John Arezzi permission to start a fan club in my honor, signed and dated Fred Blassie, December 6, 1971. So here I am with my piece of paper and my friend who I went, you know, my friend was very skeptical, Frank Favalli, and he was like, you're not going to get backstage with that. I was like, I don't know. I'm going to try. You know, I want to start. What do you want to start a fan club? I said, I want to start a fan club for him. So we were kind of bickering back and forth. And I take this white piece of paper, typewritten, and I go to the entrance, the curtain, you know, where the guys come out, and there's like three security guards there, and they're not really very enamored to see a young kid. Like, you know, what do you want? What do you want, kid? I was like, I want to see Fred Blassie. I want him to get this permission slip signed because I'm going to start a fan club for him. So if you could bring me backstage, it'll just take a couple of minutes. And you're crazy. What do you mean? You're not going backstage. And so I'm like, well, I need to get this signed. I mean, this is the way you have to start a fan club. And I remember there was a younger security guard there and he was just looking at me and he was like, hold on a second. And he takes the paper and he goes backstage with it. And I'm sitting, you know, I'm standing there. I'm all like nervous. Maybe he's going to take me backstage. You know, what that's going on. I'm waiting. And finally, about 5 minutes later, he comes out with a signed permission slip. Freddie Blassie signed it, dated it, and that was that. So, I'm like, well, you know, you can't get backstage, but here's your permission slip. It's signed. And I go back to my seat, and my friend is like, you're crazy. That guy just went backstage and he signed it. That's not Blassie's autograph. He didn't sign that. And it looked real to me. So I knew that Jeff Walton, who was the former Fred Blassie fan club president, who was also a promoter in Los Angeles and worked for the Olympic Auditorium as a PR director. I had his address from the magazine. So I put this little, I wrote him a nice letter and I'm starting Fred. I know you had Freddie Blassie's fan club and you're now a promoter and you're now PR. And I want to start a fan club with Blassie. He signed this permission slip. I didn't see him sign it. So I want to know if it's authentic, and a nice letter. So I mailed it to California at the Olympic Auditorium. And about 3 weeks later, I get a package in the mail and I open it up. And it's a long letter from Jeff Walton saying that, yes, indeed, this is an authentic Fred Blassie signed permission slip. This is Freddie's signature. This is his handwriting. It's authentic. And also in the package was a bunch of programs from the Olympic Auditorium, which I loved watching on TV, some cardboard masks of Freddie Blassie with the eyes punched out. And I was like, holy smokes, it's real. I'm on my way. I could start the fan club now. So that was Jeff Walton changed my life in a lot of ways. And I got to meet the guy a couple of years ago at the Cauliflower Alley Club when they were giving him an induction. And Jeff and I stayed correspondents for a lot of years. And it was a pleasure to finally get a chance to thank him for what he did for me way back in 1971.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Oh, wow. What a great story. And it's funny to hear you say it like this, because Jeff Walton went from being a Fred Blassie fan club to being a promoter, as you did also.
That's right. I followed in his footsteps, I guess. But what a great guy. And his son Scott, got a chance to meet him. Good family, good people. And to this day, I can never thank him enough for helping me.
You know, you always talk about it. It's nice to be important, but it is more important to be nice. And you never know how what you do can affect other people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And he could have just said, not even written you back. He could have just kept it or thrown it away. He didn't owe you anything.
No.
And not only did he send it back to you, but he sent you a box of programs.
I know.
And the face. That is really, really nice. And if it wasn't for that, we may not have you today.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. You pay it forward, right? And that's what I've always done in my life in wrestling. I've always tried to pay it forward to people and open the door and make a connection or be nice to someone. It's like, what does it take to be nice and to have a gesture of kindness or help someone in whatever way you can? I mean, it's paying it forward. And that's the way I live my life and always have been. And a lot of it maybe had to do with Jeff Walton doing that for me back in 1971.
Absolutely. And I tell you this story now, but like one of the reasons I enjoy helping you, Richie, and myself is not only working with you at the conventions, but years later, we didn't work with you. We knew you were doing a personal appearance with Hawk from the Road Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, me and Richie go, we got to go. We got to go meet Hawk. And we get there to meet Hawk, and you pull us aside with Hawk to be with him and get a picture with him. And I don't even know if I got anything signed at the time. I don't know if I had anything at the time to sign for him. And I said to him, I wanted the picture with him. I wanted to get the picture from the poster at the time where Animal's down on one knee and Hawk is doing the pressing on his back. And I got that picture real quick. I go, can I get another picture? He goes, yeah, what do you want? I go, press me. And you said, whoa, 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 whoa. He goes, come here, kid. And you're like, I have a picture of Hawk from the Road Warriors pressing this fat tub of goo, because I didn't know how to be stiff or strict or put my hands anywhere. I knew nothing.
Yeah.
Straight up in the air. It's one of my favorite pictures of all time. When I show people, it still brings a tear to my eye, because if it wasn't for you, I would never have gotten that. That is just like, and then we became friends and we saw him at ECW and we became his chauffeurs when he was in ECW. We got dinners and lunches with him. He was a fantastic guy. But if it wasn't for you, John, thank you for that. So when you always ask me, like, why am I doing this? Because you were always nice to us. You didn't have to be. You always been nice to Richie and myself. So we enjoy
you're good
doing
people
this with you,
too. You know? I mean, you know, we worked together at WGBB for a while. And after Chris Brandemart, was that his name?
Chris Brandemart.
He's Dr. Whitefinger. If you listen to the podcast, because I'm listening now as we're doing the podcast, the Pro Wrestling Spotlight podcast, he's on each and every episode. And I call him Dr. Whitefinger every week because he cut his thumb and he had it wrapped up. And then you come in like after Dr. Whitefinger. Then.
Yeah, because Dr. Whitefinger had to be out for one time. So I came in and we traded back and forth for a little while and then we were in it, did it together. And I'll tell you what, we'll have to get Dr. Whitefinger on one of your Zooms.
Yes, we
because
will.
Because I got together with him recently on Facebook. We found each other on Facebook. Yeah.
He's still around. That's good. It's good to hear.
Well, let's get back to the match. I know people listening go, how did the match end? Well, this is a Roman gladiator match.
What a farce.
What a farce. But first of all, the Roman gladiator match, the first one was done in May 1970. Freddie Blassie took on his former tag team partner, Don Carson, for Blassie's American title. And there was a lot. I have a lot of rules here. No time limit, no disqualification, no doctor stopping, no holds bar, no pinfalls, no referees. No, there's a lot of things that you need to do to be an official Roman gladiator match. How many of these rules did you have at the Garden? Do you remember were any of these?
I do remember. And I know that the Roman gladiator death match was also a concept that was originated with Jeff Walton and Fred Blassie in Los Angeles. You know, based on what you heard from what happened in L.A. for Roman gladiator death matches, nothing on this list took place at Madison Square Garden, even though they promoted it as a Roman gladiator death match, because the New York State Athletic Commission would not allow this type of match. Even though they promoted it, it's not within their guidelines or their covenants that you could have anything like this in New York State, or at least at the Garden.
So how did they go over with the match? So first of all, there was no time limit, no disqualification, no doctor stopping the match.
Supposedly.
No holds bar, no pinfalls, no referee, no surrender.
There was a referee.
No surrender. Loser dragged around the ring.
Yeah, none of that happened.
And there must be they're also called for 5 judges at ringside.
None of it happened. None of it. Not a thing. It was stopped because of blood. It was a crazy 7 minutes and change. Blassie was bleeding. It was a wild brawl. And then the referee ruled that Blassie couldn't continue. And that was the end of it. Blassie didn't get pinned.
But he lost.
He did lose.
So the match lasted an amazing amount of time, almost 7 minutes, 14 seconds, which is an amazing amount of time. It just surprised me. Let me ask you, going back to like these Blassie matches, his last match was a short match. Did Freddie Blassie do long matches, or did he have to do long matches? He just have done short matches?
Here's what happened. I mean, Blassie was such a heel, and Morales was so beloved. They were afraid of a riot. So the match would quickly end if there was a crowd that seemed to be getting ready to surge the ring. And I think that's what happened in this match. I think it could have continued longer, but the fans went in such a frenzied uproar and things were getting thrown into the ring. And there was a guy, I never forget it. I mean, a guy was billy clubbed because he tried to get into the ring.
Okay, let's go back to this atmosphere now. Now, we're in the match is coming up next. Last time I remember you telling us that you actually looked over and you saw his white hair, because there's no music at the time.
Right.
People. No music. So you saw this guy with white hair and you knew it was Blassie. He's coming to the ring.
Yeah.
Now, you also told me there were no ring, you know.
There was no barricade.
So what did they do when they knew they were going to have a match like this? Did they put more police out there?
Yeah, there's a big police presence, the security guards, and they're all kind of billy clubs. But there's still never enough in this particular show, in this match. I mean, there was not enough. I mean, you know, and once you have to drag somebody out with a, you know, hitting him with a billy club, you know, one of the craziest things that happened, we'll cover it next year. And I don't want to tip too much off, but a fan, when King Curtis hit bloodied Monsoon, and Monsoon hit a gusher, as they say in the business. I mean, he hit something and the blood was spurting out of his forehead. A fan ran into the ring and wrapped a towel around his head. It wrapped a shirt or something to stop the bleeding. And, you know, that was a surreal situation. But in this particular case, I mean, I think that's what the reason was why it was only 7 minutes, because Blassie could have gone longer. You know, he may not have been able to go 15 or 20 minutes consecutively. But there were matches later on in Blassie's career when he fought Chief J. Strongbow, where it was a 25-30 minute match. So he could go.
A health thing. It wasn't a health thing for him, because I know he had...
No, he was old, but he could go.
Okay. So going back to the atmosphere at the Garden at this time, here it comes, you know, of course you have Freddie Blassie come out first, being the challenger, Pedro Morales being the champion comes out, the match starts. Do you think backstage, you know, I'm sure I want to ask you about like them sitting down with the ref and going, okay, if this thing starts getting out of hand, when should we go home?
That would be a signal that takes place from the back and that they would send somebody up to ringside and inform the timekeeper, who would signal the referee. And, you know, and then there was no microphones or headsets like there is today, obviously. But that would have to be a call that's made from Vince McMahon Sr. if he saw things getting out of hand a little bit. Or the commission could have just went, you know, this is getting out of hand. Stop it. And they would have the authority to stop the match by telling the referee. And the referees were employees of the State Athletic Commission. It wasn't like it's today where they were employees of the WWE. Back then, all the referees were New York State Athletic Commission referees. They were all licensed and hired and paid by the New York State Athletic Commission. So they were told when the commissioner's at ringside and he gives an order, that order has to be followed, even though it was wrestling.
But were they in on were the referees in on it? Did they know? They had to know. They're the referees. That's the job of a referee.
Well, yeah,
know what's going
yeah.
On.
That that part, yes, of course, they knew that this match is going to be a finish, and you give the signals or you say when it's time to go home or whatever. And usually the heel is calling the match anyway. So whatever happened this night. For that match to be such short, so short in duration, there had to be some concern that the crowd was going to erupt into a scene that no one really wanted to see.
Yeah. And I just didn't, I was just thinking about like, if I'm getting paid by somebody and then I'm listening to somebody else go, okay, this is what you, cause you, like we said in other episodes, the commission didn't know that this thing was fixed, didn't know wrestling wasn't as authentic as it wanted to be perceived. So they were always believing everything that's going on. So if they came over and they
to
go, hey,
stop
the
match. To a certain extent though, Timmy, yeah. I mean, you know, they knew it was not on the up and up, but they did control it with an iron fist. They did. They had their rules and regulations, and it went back years and years previously to when Dick the Bruiser got banned for life at Madison Square Garden. The Sheik, the same thing, just because of the way they put the crowd up into a frenzy. So, I mean, the commission wasn't they were not scared to ban somebody for life. They were very strict and they regulated wrestling back then almost as strict as they did boxing. Their jobs were primarily to oversee boxing, but wrestling was part of it. It was considered a sport until McMahon declared it not a sport in New Jersey. And, you know, then the commissions finally, you know, eventually went away. But at that time, even though they knew it wasn't on the up and up, they still ruled it almost like it was a real contest.
Interesting. So how would you rate this card? It seems like you had three tag teams in here. You had a title change. You had Freddie Blassie. Was this the favorite card you've ever seen?
No.
Was it one of the top cards?
Well, I was still new in attending live matches. It was great for Blassie. It was great for me because I got the permission slip signed. It was very disappointing for me because Blassie lost. And I knew that even though I wasn't totally smartened up yet, I mean, I still had the slight suspension of disbelief in a way where maybe, you know, Freddie could win and he should win because he's Freddie Blassie and Morales. I didn't like, he wasn't Bruno and, you know, and I felt, you know, I used to say that he used to bribe the referees, you know, just like, you know, a mark, you know, really, but that's kind of, if I have to rate the card, I mean, the go home tag team title win was great. I was exhilarated because of the title change. I was disappointed, but still excited because I got the permission slip signed. I saw Freddie Blassie wrestle, and I was disappointed because I knew that, okay, he lost to Morales. So what happens next? And what happens next is that he leaves the territory.
And that's interesting, too, him leaving the territory. He's only there, like, we'll take back the Stan Stasiak. Stan Stasiak stays, and he goes down the card. So you see Stan Stasiak. If you're going to go to see any matches, you'll have 6 months to see Stan Stasiak. He'll be wrestling around for a while. But with Freddie Blassie being so short, I think it also makes it better go, oh, we got to go see him because he may not be back. So it gives a little urgency to go into some matches because you may not see this person again. They may lose and never come back. So you never know who's coming and who's going.
He was gone for a year after this show. That was it. He was in high demand in Los Angeles as a babyface. He did have some injuries in 72, which put him out of action a little bit. And he was still in high demand in Japan, and he wrestled in Hawaii a lot. So his main territory really was Los Angeles in that Southern California market. And he was actually a promoter in one of the towns as well. I believe it was in El Monte, California. And then he'd do his Japan stuff, and then he would do his you know, his Los Angeles stuff. And that was kind of what he did in 1972.
Why did he come to the Garden then? Why do you think, what drew, do you think it was like they offered him a lot of
sellouts?
Okay.
He had a good relationship with Vince Sr. And then eventually Vince Jr. I mean, he was like a grandfather to the kids, Vince's kids, Vince Jr.'s kids. And he was somebody that they knew that no matter where he was going to be, they can ensure almost a sellout for him. And it was kind of cool because after I started the fan club, he wrestled at the Brooklyn Rollerama in front of like 500 people. And I was there with my little sister and got to see him in like a little place. And I think he fought El Olympico and beat him. So I was so happy I got to see Freddie win, you know, and that was later on. That was in 73.
When did he start becoming a manager?
74. He had a run, you know, after 73 and I got the postcard, you know, and that he wrote me telling me that he was going to be staying for an extended stay in New York. And I didn't know that he was going to come in as a manager initially because he didn't share that in a postcard that he sent me from Japan. He just indicated that he was going to be there for a long time. And then he shows up as the manager of Nikolai Volkov. And then he did don the tights in June of 74 when he teamed up with Volkov against Strongbow and Sammartino. So as I'm shuffling through my papers here because I do have a postcard from Freddie. Here it is. I'm going to read it to you.
And we should put this also on Patreon, John.
Absolutely. This will be on Patreon. The postcard will be there. Having a wonderful time here in Japan. So far, the wrestling tour has been a huge success. The weather has been perfect. Hope it continues until the tour ends. From here, I go to Hawaii for a 10-day stay to regain my suntan. Hope everything is well with you, Fred. I'll be coming to New York for an extended stay after that.
I forgot about the Freddie Blassie tan. For anybody who doesn't know, in the day, very few wrestlers had tans, but Freddie Blassie was always the golden one. He always looked great. He always had that beautiful tan. And that's funny. After Japan, I'm going to Hawaii to work on my tan.
Yes. By the way, that postcard was July of 73.
Wow. And getting back to the matches, so Pedro defended his title. And next month, since Freddie is out, we're going to bring in Professor Turo Tanaka to take on Pedro Morales for the championship.
Yeah, they are pushing him hard, and that was another one in the succession of contenders that were now going through Morales each and every month. They were bringing somebody in to win a few matches on TV with name recognition, and Pedro had a nice winning streak going on as we get into 1972.
Professor Tanaka, just like a lot of other wrestlers, come in for the title. They can't win the title, but then they start going down the card and doing other things. And then he became a tag team partner, I think, of Mr. Fuji. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. They Tanaka was beloved. I mean, he was a good worker and he had a great relationship with Vince. So he would come in and, you know, in this run, he ascended pretty quickly. But I guess the long term plan, they would plan this stuff really not like it is today. I mean, there was long-term booking here where they would decide what was going to go on. And what everybody says about Vince McMahon, he would always give somebody a start date and an end date. He said, you're going to start on this date. You're going to end on this date. This is what you're going to do during that time. And he was a man of his word. He never changed direction. So they knew when they did a deal with Vince Sr. and there were no contracts, it was all handshake, that he was going to live up to what he said. And they get paid on this day coming in. This is your last day. Then you go. And that was it. That's how we did business with the wrestlers back then.
Interesting. And going back to Tanaka, when did he do the Bond film? Remember he was in a Bond film? I think it was it Goldfinger? Or
oh, yeah, he was. I think that was later on in the mid-70s. I'm not really sure, but I know that it wasn't during this time period, I don't believe.
And if you have any great memories from wrestling at the Garden in the 70s, please send them along. We'd love to hear from you. Send it to john@metmemories.com. That's john@metmemories.com. And John will read your story and answer your questions.
Yeah, you know what, Tim? I'm going to tell you something. There's not very many people that are probably alive back then. So we haven't gotten a story yet. So I hope we get one because there were... You know, I don't really run into anybody that was around during then. And I guess I'm a freaking old bastard now. But I still have the Matt memories, don't I, of this historic time.
Listen, if your name is Bill Apter and you want to send a question in to John, we'll accept those also.
Oh, my God, yes. Bill, tell us a story. He's got plenty of the garden, as is my good friend George Napolitano.
Oh, George. Okay, you mentioned him. I'll give you a great George Napolitano story real quick. George Napolitano was working. He was shooting for the UWF, and it was at that hotel in New York, wherever they filmed.
Penta.
I can't remember. The Penta Hotel. And I had just bought his book. He had a wrestling book. And I got there, and I was having people sign it, and then I saw him, and I said, would you mind signing this for me? He says, no problem. He goes, let me take it in the back for you. And he took it in the back, and he got, I know he got the Cheetah Kid for me, and he also got one of the Samoans for me in it.
Paying it forward. That's Georgie. He did that with me all the time. He opened up doors. He introduced me to people. He said I was okay. You know, meaning that I'm okay. You could talk to him. That's the power that George had, and he was a mentor to me in a big way.
Good guy. We'll have to get him on the podcast because he's just a great guy to talk to, and he also has great stories. And he was also at your convention every year. He showed up every year.
Yeah. Yeah, we were like, you know, frickin' frack. I mean, we traveled the roads together. We did so much, and I would love to have George even kind of reminisce with us here one of these episodes.
And if you'd like to be one of the first people to hear 50-year flashback of wrestling at Madison Square Garden, all you got to do is go to our Patreon, www.patreon.com/JohnArizzi. Members in the Superfan, PWS Associate Producer, Producer, or Executive Producers tier will get access to this show early. And starting at only $5 a month, it'll get you in the door and you'll have access to all the original Pro Wrestling Spotlight original broadcasts from 1989 to 1995. And the higher the level, the more benefits you'll get. From Zoom calls with John Arizzi, access to 8mm films we discuss here, to unseen videos and vintage magazines being sent out to you. And there's only one way to experience it all, and that's becoming a member of John's Patreon page. Patreon.com/John Arizzi. Join a community, hear the history. Patreon.com/John Arizzi. We've been talking all the time about your Patreon, John. New stuff coming in all the time.
That is correct. I mean, we're always uploading stuff. I mean, right now, there's got to be 150 different posts up there with vintage archives of mine. And I mean, for $5 to get in, $10 level gets you a little bit more, as does 25 and up and up. I think you'll be very satisfied. And it's really, you know, instead of buying one Starbucks coffee, send it over to me at patreon.com/JohnArizzi, and you will relive this history.
And do me a favor, John, since I never ask you for anything, but if you can please put some of this Freddie Blassie commemorative stuff on there today. Like if you can find, I know you have it somewhere, the card that he signed. I would love to see that.
Oh, yeah. The which one? The postcard or the permission slip?
Well, you read the postcard. Definitely put the postcard. But if you can find the permission slip.
I know where the permission slip is.
All right.
It's in Canada.
You need to get it back.
It was book research. So, yeah, I have to get it back.
Or at least have him take a picture of it so you can post
it. I want it back. It's, you know, it's mine.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we want to thank again Scott Teal for his great book, Wrestling at the Garden.
Yes, you could get it. Still available. CrowbarPress.com. Scott Teal's wonderful Bible that he did with a guy named Fred Hornby with a lot of it, and J. Michael Kenyon. It's a fabulous book. It's our Bible here for this podcast.
Fantastic. Anything else, John?
No, man. I really appreciate it. This is getting really exciting every month. And now that we're officially a podcast and we'll be out there distributed internationally, I think the fans are really going to enjoy what we have in store for them as we keep reliving this history from the Mecca, Madison Square Garden.
For John Arizzi and Richie Garcia, I'm Tim Poutre. We'll see you next time. We'll be right back.